Welcome back to Living Lab Radio. I'm Heather Goldstone. People in different countries often speak different languages, and even within a community, different groups may have distinct dialects or slang. Turns out, the same is true of pilot whales. Amy Van Sice is a postdoctoral scholar at Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution and lead author on a new study documenting distinct dialects among pilot whales. Welcome to the show.
Hi, great to be here.
Let's start off and just like orient people to what a pilot whale sounds like. We've got a little bit of sound that you actually recorded. I mean, it's a lot of like squeaking and clicking. It sounds almost like dolphin sounds, not like what we'd think of with, you know, a humpback whale song or something like that.
Yeah, shortfin pilot whales are actually often referred to as the canaries of the ocean. Because they have such kind of sing-songy type whistles. And interestingly, they are actually dolphins. They are not whales.
Okay.
So they do have dolphin type whistles.
And you can actually hear different dialects. I mean, I'm amazed that you can tell one squeaking, clicking whale from another. Can you tell individuals apart?
I wish. That would be really cool. But no, on the whole, I am not actually good enough to myself hear the difference between one whale or another. But if you take kind of a whole group and you compare the sum total of what the sounds that one group makes to what another group makes, there are kind of distinct differences between those.
Interesting. I mean, the amount of data that must go into actually doing this analysis is kind of mind-blowing, actually, that you've got to have recordings of individuals in different groups. But then to actually know that there are different groups, you've got to have observations of their behavior, that they're hanging out together. And then you've actually got genetic data from each of them to know how distinct these groups are, whether they're kind of swapping groups. It's a huge amount of data.
It's a huge amount of data. And I was so lucky to be able to be part of this project. I came onto it kind of after a lot of the groundwork had already been done by an organization called Cascadia Research Collective, which is based in Olympia, Washington. And they've been doing field projects in Hawaii for, it's got to be almost 20 years now. And throughout that entire time, they've been collecting photographs and observations of these animals and documenting every time they saw two animals together, which two animals they saw together.
Wow.
And so for every animal in their data set, they know how much time those animals spend together.
Wow.
So yeah.
Within those groups that are hanging out together, what are they actually using the vocalizations for? Do we know?
We don't know very specifically, but there are some ideas. There was a study done by another scientist here at Woods Hole that showed that they continue to make social calls while they're diving to hunt. And they think that that might be so that they can maintain contact with animals on the surface so that when they come back up to the surface, they can reunite. Because if you imagine, you know, hunting in the ocean, it's very, very dark down at those incredible depths.
And they have how deep are they going?
They're going down to 500 to sometimes 800 meters.
Wow.
Yeah, they're diving deep and they're mostly hunting for squid. And so they have to, when they're coming back to the surface, have a way to find the rest of their group. Like I said, they stay in these kind of smaller social groups for what we think might be their entire lives.
And basically so, hanging out with their family, or are they genetically related, or are these
more
friend groups that they find?
So those small groups are like immediate families, brothers and sisters and parents. And then the larger groups that they sometimes associate with are aunts and uncles and cousins.
What does that mean for the genetics of these animals if they're really spending all of their time with their immediate family when they breed and reproduce? Are they mixing with other groups at that point?
What we can see in the genetic signal is that there doesn't seem to be a strong signal of inbreeding, which means that these animals are sometimes leaving their group to mate with other groups. But there is a lot of genetic similarity between them. So we think that when they're in those extended family groupings is when possibly a lot of the mating happens, with some mixing between non-related individuals.
So then when you talk about these groups of whales having different dialects in the calls that they use, I mean, how different are they and at what level? Is it those immediate families or the extended families?
So what we looked at was the extended families. And what we found was that they differed in two different ways. The first was just the overall shape, contour of the calls that they produce. So we went through and manually identified every single call we found in every single recording. And
wow.
It took a bit of time. And what we found was that each group had its own kind of distinct set of calls that it would use. And some were shared between groups. You know, there was some evidence that different groups had learned other groups' calls. But when you looked at kind of the total of calls that was made by each group, they were all distinctly different.
Do you have any sense of whether that's a genetic thing or whether that's a learned behavior in terms of the type of vocalization they make?
I think that it's a learned behavior. And the reason for that is because these groups of animals are genetically distinct, but not so genetically distinct that it would account for something like acoustic differences.
So it really is like human language, that you learn the language that you grow up with.
Yeah. And there's lots of examples of different species of whales being able to learn languages and even kind of interspecific learning among species. For example, there's some killer whales that learned to produce bottlenose dolphin sounds when they were in captivity.
Amazing.
Yeah. So we know that this can happen. And there's evidence that, you know, especially in killer whales, which are a really well-known, well-studied species, we have evidence that it kind of is transferred from parent to offspring. But there's kind of also the opportunity for more horizontal or social learning, where you're just kind of learning from conspecifics in your group.
You've compared this to human groups with different slang or dialects. I mean, it's like, you know, you've got Valley Girl, or you've got you kind of hang out in cliques and you develop your own language, your own dialects.
Yeah. So it is a much more familial thing for this group of whales than I think it tends to be for us as humans. But that's exactly what it is. These animals are living in an area where there's kind of no barriers to mixing at all, right? They share the exact same space, and yet they have to maintain their own groups. And so one of the ways that they can do that is by having kind of distinctly different sounds that they can use to identify themselves and their own group belonging. And that's going to especially help them when they come in contact with other large groups. If you can imagine, you know, two groups of, say, 70 to 100 whales coming in contact with each other in the middle of the ocean and trying to figure out which one is who and what group they belong to, it's kind of a really difficult thing to do visually, especially, you know, when you get into depth in the water, again, where it's dark. Sound can really, really be helpful in that situation.
Do you think this is probably a phenomenon that happens in other social whales and we just haven't picked up on it yet?
Absolutely. Yeah. We have studied to a greater extent killer whales and sperm whales, and people are now starting to look at longfin pilot whales and shortfin pilot whales. But I think that the more that we look into this, the more we're going to see that social behavior is important in a lot of marine mammals and potentially even other marine top predators.
What are the ramifications of that when we think about conservation of these species?
Yeah, that's actually a really interesting and important question that we need to start thinking about. Basically, the way we manage species right now is kind of very focused on this idea of geographic stocks. And so we'll look at an area, say the area around Hawaii or the area off the East Coast here, and we will take that entire group of animals and call it a single stock because it shares the same geographic space. But the truth of the matter is that there could be several different groups using and sharing that space together, and each of those groups represents a different evolutionary strategy, a different kind of ecological niche space that it fills. And if we were to start losing one or another of those groups, we are kind of chipping away at the evolutionary resilience of that species as a whole without even realizing it.
It makes the conservation work a lot more difficult in a way. We've got to know a lot more and be monitoring in a much more intensive way.
It does. It's a little daunting. But I think that, you know, if we don't do it, we're going to be missing out on a lot.
So where do you go from here with this research?
Well, right now I'm taking a step backward, or a step out, I guess, and I'm looking at a more global perspective. There's some evidence that although we consider them to be one species, there might be two or even three separate subspecies that are going through this speciation process.
I mean, I was going to ask you that earlier. If you've got these extended families that are being pretty exclusive to each other, is that on its way to becoming different subspecies or species?
Yeah, so it's hard to tell on such a small regional scale if any of that genetic diversity will last for long enough, you know, on the kind of huge evolutionary timescales that it takes to create a species. But at a larger scale, in the Pacific Ocean, there are two different types of short-finned pilot whale, and they're morphologically different, and they're acoustically different, and they're also genetically different. And they look like two different subspecies, or potentially even species. But there are areas, like in the central Pacific and off the coast of Japan, where these two very different animals interact with each other all the time, and yet they seem not to be mixing. And so that, again, is another interesting way that social structure is going to come to play within these animals, because we don't have any reason to believe that they shouldn't be mixing. So social structure is a potential viable answer for why they have chosen not to.
I mean, that's interesting in and of itself, because in evolution, you know, we tend to say, okay, well, you know, there has to be some barrier that would separate populations in order to create two new species. But in this case, the species themselves are creating the barrier.
Right. Yeah. And that is exactly why this is so interesting. As far as we know, there's no geographic, oceanographic, or ecological barrier that would stop these animals from mixing with each other. They are simply choosing not to mix.
It's got to be pretty cool to feel like you're watching evolution in action. I mean, we tend to think of evolution as this past thing that brought us to where we are, and we have this misconception that, like, it's stopped, right? Like, evolution happened and now we have all the life on Earth and that's it. But you're watching evolution actually happening.
Yeah, and that's one of the reasons why I love genetics, and one of the reasons why I think acoustics is a really great tool to pair with genetics, is because evolution hasn't stopped.
Amy Van Sice is a postdoctoral scholar at Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution and lead author on a new study documenting distinct dialects among pilot whales. Amy, thanks so much for coming in and talking with us.
Thank you.
And that's our show. Remember, we want to know more about how the partial government shutdown is affecting science and how that is affecting you. If you're a researcher or someone who uses government data or services in your work, get in touch with us and share your story. You can email us. We're livinglabradio@wgbh.org. You can also tweet us @livinglabradio or find Living Lab Radio on Facebook. Until next week, I'm Heather Goldstone. Thanks for listening.
Living Lab Radio is produced by WCAI in Woods Hole and WGBH Radio in Boston. It's produced by me, Elsa Partan, and Heather Goldstone is executive producer. Funding for Living Lab Radio comes from the Candida Fund, investing in transformative leaders and ideas. Theme music by Stellwagen Symphonette.